Needless to say, I am not George McGovern. The real Senator McGovern is at home, in bed, with the flu. He has a rather steady and high fever. Called me yesterday, just before noon, to tell me of this indisposition, and to assure me that he would be with us next Sunday at this time. I'm afraid these Koblitz lectureships over the years have now and again put me in the business of instant sermons. You'll recall a few years ago, Ambassador Galbraith was to be with us, and we received then at midnight Saturday a call from Omaha, Nebraska. The last plane had just flown overhead, and he was stranded there with no chance of getting to Cleveland. Well, he came a year later. Senator McGovern and Yirtzeh Hashem will come a week later. And Senator McGovern, thank God, gave me a little more lead time. I'd like to completely change the kind of subject matter that was going to be dealt with this morning, in part because any discussion of foreign policy, of course, requires the kind of attention that can't be given to it standing on one foot or sitting down for one or two sessions at one's desk. And in part because we began several weeks ago a series of discussions and background briefings on our Atikot exhibit, an archaeological exhibit which will take place here at the temple beginning in early May. And I had planned out, frankly, three such discussions with you. If Senator McGovern is going to preempt my discussion next week, I'm going to preempt his foreign policy this morning. So if you can, shift moods from the contemporary to the historical, from the immediate to the past, from the urgent to the simply pleasantly intellectual, and go back with me 5, 6, 7,000 years. Let's look a little bit at the history of the ancient Holy Land and the history of our people on that land. And let's begin by reminding ourselves that even the most noted of professions has its rather strange and bizarre sides to it. We rarely think of it in this light, but actually a field archaeologist spends a good bit of his time being a very efficient and meticulous grave robber. Most of the fine art objects, which you'll see in the Cleveland Museum of Art or the Metropolitan Museum or the Israel Museum, which come from Assyria, Babylon, Syria, Egypt, the ancient Middle East, were at one time or another found in tombs or sarcophagi, mausoleums, and only because we were able to take away what had been once buried with the dead and bring it again to life do we have many of the objects which recreate for us the background and the material culture of these quite wonderful early civilizations. Most of the people of the Middle East left with their dead some or all of the possessions of their dead. They left food and drink to tide them over the long journey into the netherworld. They left the badges and the treasure of their rank so that the dead would be assured that once they got to heaven, once they got to paradise, they'd be welcomed in a manner appropriate to their station in this life. And they left with them mementos of their earthly existence, much the way you sometimes still see a mother place a photograph or a toy in the coffin of the child, or a man being buried in the uniform or the academic or ecclesiastical robes of his profession. And the earth covered up these relics, and some of them were protected by rather ingenious safeguard devices. All of them were protected by man's primordial fear about the place of the dead, that very same anxiety which makes a child, you know, close his eyes and hold his breath while he passes a cemetery or a graveyard. And so where are those objects, the artifacts of the ancient world which remained above ground, were either broken or lost or simply disappeared? Most of those that were part of a nation's burial have remained, or a good part of these have remained. And it is these which we see and marvel at in our museums. Not all, of course, has remained. If you visit Jerusalem, they'll point out to you in the side of a cliff in the Kidron Valley what looks to be simply a cave face which has fallen in. And they'll say to you that this was the cave burial ground of the kings of the house of David. In ancient times, this was within the walls of Kiryat David, the old city of Jerusalem. But again, in ancient times, scavengers and professional grave robbers raided these royal tombs, took away all that was worth taking away. And in later ages, in Roman times, in the medieval ages, this face of the cliff was quarried simply as a stone quarry. So very little except a niche in the rock remains. But the graves of those who were not so famous, not so wealthy, where grave robbers did not assume the treasure remains, remained to a certain degree intact. And many of these have now been opened, and their treasure is our treasure. If it had not been for the fact that the ancients buried much of the living utensils of the living world, the daily objects of their period with their dead, we would know not half as much as we do about these ancient civilizations. And parenthetically, I would add that it is precisely this grave-robbing aspect of archaeology which sometimes in Israel brings into being a confrontation between the observant Jew and the field archaeologist. Every once in a while, you read in the press that archaeologists working in one gravesite or another have suddenly been demonstrated against by the Naturae Cartae, by some other of the Orthodox groups. And the reasons are interesting and in their own way quite understandable. Alone among the people of antiquity, our ancestors came to the conviction that unless people could be trained to have respect for the dead, they really could never be retained to have reverence for the living, reverence for life. That if you treat the ashes and the bones of the dead with contempt and you toss them hither and yon and as if they had never been, this carries over into your rather callous treatment of the living. And so we read in the book of Deuteronomy a law which is unique to its time, which says that someone who is executed by the state for whatever crime, he must be cut down from the gibbet, cut down from the gallows the same day as his execution. It was the custom in the ancient Middle East among most peoples, as it is still in Iraq today, as we remember from the spy trials of just 3 weeks ago, to have a condemned man hanged by the noose from the gallows until the vultures have desiccated the body or until the body is simply disintegrated. But we, our ancestors, were unwilling to allow the body to be dealt with anything but reverence. It was to be buried the selfsame day. All bodies were to be buried the selfsame day. And the bones, the sleep of the dead, was not to be disturbed. Now this concern with a reverence for death, even as we have a reverence for life, became part of the halakha, became part of the law. And these traditional Jews appear sometimes at the ossuaries and at the cave sites where the dead are buried to make sure that when the archaeologists go in for their very legitimate work, they do not, in effect, toss hither and yon as you might the bits of shard of pottery, the bones of those who are buried in this place. And we must, of course, respect the tradition and the concerns which lead to such demonstrations. Now, graves can tell us a great deal. They can tell us something about the philosophy, the way of life, the attitudes towards life of the culture, the people who were buried therein. Even if Napoleon's army had not found the Rosetta Stone, even if the scientists had not decoded the cipher of the hieroglyphs, even if the Egyptian Book of the Dead and the other execratory texts which tell us something about Egyptian theology and thought, were not available to us in our own language. We would know a great deal about Egyptian ideas of the transmigration of the soul, of the resurrection of the body, of the passage of this, of the life from this world to a much better other world, just by going into the tombs that remain of pharaonic Egypt and seeing the elaborate mummification and embalming procedures, the beautifully constructed sarcophagi, the magnificently and symbolically painted tombs, and the rich treasure, the household furniture, the household utensils, the food, the jewels, the money that was left in these tombs by the family of those who survived. And to bring the issue closer to hand, I remember being at Gezer, which is a tell site between the airport at Lida and the Jerusalem itself, just south of the main road, some 2 years ago, when those who were excavating there happened to push through the base of the main gate into the city. They were now in a pre-Canaanite level, probably the 18th or 19th century BC. And they came across an ovoid piece of hollow pottery, which broke open to the touch of their pick. And inside was the skeleton of a small child. And we had here an example of what is common through the ancient Middle East, the sacrifice of a child as a propitiatory offering to the gods in order to gain the gods' favor upon the city that was being built or the walls which were to protect the city or a particular home. Now, interestingly, in no Israelite site, in no Judean site, in no building or fortress or citadel or palace constructed by our ancestors was such a child sacrifice, has such a child sacrifice ever been found. When our people wrote the story of the sacrifice of Isaac in Genesis, they were saying, among other things, that God did not want the sacrifice of human life. Now, this is that which is most precious to us. It is also most precious to him. He wants us to give of ourselves to make the sacrifice of a humble and contrite heart, to give something of ourselves to the sanctuary, to the educational system of the state. But the sacrifice of human life was anathema to our people. And this too marks one of the significant breaks that Judaism brings about in the development of the religious and moral sensitivity of mankind. So graves have told us a great deal about the art and the objects and the thought, philosophy, and the religion of ancient man. And in Atikut, as in any ancient museum of antiquities, most of the objects that you will see come from such grave sites, come from such mortuaries and such sepulchres. As you walk into the exhibit, one of the first and earliest major items which you will see is a tallish, hollow piece of pottery, which looks a little bit, from the front, as if it were a highly stylized sheep. It's about 3.5 feet long, perhaps 2 feet tall. The body is taller than broad, somewhat roundish. There is a piece which makes both the feet and a tail, which rises above the body, the hollow body of the item. And there is a face which rises above in the front, which has a hooked nose and a large squarish mouth. Now, this is an ossuary. It's an object in which the ancients, in this case, people who lived about 3,500 years before the Common Era, placed the ashes and the bones of their dead, whom they had first cremated and whom they now reburied in such an object for permanent burial. Near Atzor, which is just outside of Tel Aviv, a French archaeologist by the name of Jean Perrault found some 12 years ago 50 of these ossuaries in one tunnel grave cut into the soft sandstone of the area. Each of them was in a different form. Some forms looked like the sheep, some forms looked like crocodiles, some forms looked like hippopotami, some looked like houses, and some like granaries. But they all had the same use. They were all ossuaries. The animals were apparently mythic guardians who protected the last remains of the dead. The houses were all rather highly painted with the eye, which is a seeing eye, which protects as a talisman the dead. And here we had the final burial place of men who lived 1,500 years before Abraham, 2,500 years before Moses and David, but people whose culture affected in very basic ways the culture of our ancestors. Because from this kind of bone burial or reburial, our ancestors took their earliest form of care of the dead. You remember reading in the book of Genesis that when Sarah, the first of the matriarchs, died, Abraham had to find a burial place for him, and he went to a Kenite who lived in the area, Hittite, and he brought from this Hittite a cave site as the family burial plot. And there Sarah was laid to rest. In the entire Middle East, people were buried either in natural caves or in artificial caves that were cut into the rather soft rock. Their bodies were brought to the cave. They simply remained there. Once the body had decomposed, the bones were collected and put into a niche further back in this cave area. Now, interestingly, the cave was always a family burial place. We know, for instance, from the book of Genesis, that all of the patriarchs insisted that their bodies be brought back to be buried in this single cave of Machpelah. And the Bible speaks continually of sleeping with one's fathers, of being laid to rest with one's fathers. It's as if our ancestors had the feeling that after all the wanderings and the journeyings and the trials of life, the real rest that a man came to came when he was now again with his own. We know from our Bible that the early Hebrews had no detailed vision of an afterlife. They didn't know what happened beyond the grave, but they must have had a dim feeling that there was some kind of continuing contact between the dead of one family, the dead of one clan. And this idea of family burial, of the family plot, goes very far back in our history. And another interesting item which has to do with burial in these very early times is that neither this early Chalcolithic ossuary, which you'll see, nor any of the burials in Israelite times in Palestine has any memorial, any inscription attached to it. Now, our ancestors were literate, but they didn't feel the need, as we do, to say, so-and-so, the son of so-and-so, is buried in this place, or to give a title, or to give some eulogy as to the person's accomplishments. Only in Greek times, under Greek influence, did the memorialization of the dead by name, by rank, and by title creep into Jewish life. And there's an old Talmudic principle to the effect, Ein osim zichronot latzadikim, divrehem heim zichronotehem. One doesn't make monuments for the dead. Their deeds are their own monument. Those who knew a man knew his worth. Those who did not know the man will not be impressed by any title his family or his generation gives him. And there has been traditionally among our people a tendency to back away from elaborate tombstones, from elaborate monuments, certainly from elaborate memorializations of the dead. Now, what do we find in these early burials? We find some very interesting things, which tell us something of the psychology and the attitudes of the time. You'll see in Atikot a clay child's rattle. You shake it, you can hear the rattle sound. It was buried with a child. The mother had buried something the child, this very young child, had loved. You'll see a little bull-like child's doll, again made out of clay. The bull is dancing off into space. The child's toy, again buried with a child. In ancient times, 2 out of 3 children died before they reached maturity. Mothers went through hell in the raising of their children. You'll find among the objects in our museum a number of merchants' measuring cups. They took the grain And they measured a cup of grain or a pint of grain or whatever the measurement of the time was, a cob it was called, into this measuring cup and leveled it off, and that's how they sold it to the housewife. And there are a number of stone and pottery weights which the merchant put on his scale to make sure that he was selling enough meat or enough produce. And these were buried with the dead, as if to say, look, God, the measuring cup, the weights which I used all my life were honest weights. I'm an honorable man, and this is the proof of my rectitude. And you'll see something else as you walk through the exhibit. You'll see an absence of jewelry and of the baubles of life. And this is very strange, because if you walk through the Egyptian galleries or the Assyrian galleries of the Metropolitan Museum, you'll see beautiful, beautifully made jewelry, necklaces of all kinds buried with the women. Our people did not bury the baubles, in part because we were not a rich civilization, in part because I think our ancestors somehow understood that whatever lay beyond the grave, whatever gates one had to pass, whatever standards one had to meet, God would not be very much impressed with the put-on and the makeup. And as you go down through the time that Atikot displays, you'll find when you reach the Greek period, the end of the biblical period, an entirely new approach to this matter of burial. Now, for the first time, you will see the ossuaries, the places in which they collected the bones, engraved in Hebrew writing. There's one in Atikot which has on it the name Shimon Bone HaHechal, Simon, the architect of the temple. And we know this man from history. This is the man who was the senior architect hired by Herod in his giant renovation project for the second temple in Jerusalem. And this is his burial ossuary. And we begin to see that now we're dealing with the Pharisees and the rabbis and with a totally new approach to death and to its meaning. The ossuary is now a box. The bones are not left simply on a ledge in a sepulcher. They are collected and collected carefully. And we know from the Mishnah, we know from rabbinic writings that at this point in time, when a man died, he was buried in the ground. And after a period of time, after the body had decomposed, his bones were picked up carefully and brought together carefully into an ossuary, a store box, and then placed in a grotto in the earth. And they made sure that every bone was there. We're dealing now with a people which, for one reason or another, has adopted a very complex idea about physical resurrection. Beginning with the image of Ezekiel in the Valley of the Dry Bones, talking with some of the imagery of Daniel about the immortality of the soul and the resurrection of the body, the Pharisees began to teach to the people, and the people began to accept a vision of an afterlife in which man would, in a sense, be spiritually reborn. And it became very important to see that all the bones were in place, that you wouldn't have a limp in the next world that you didn't have in this one. And they began to explain this burial in the ground, which had never existed before in Jewish history, as saying this was a way of expiating for one's sins. The body was dust unto dust. The earth was taking back its own. The flesh was disappearing. This was the punishment of man for whatever his sins in this world. And he was being purged so that he might enter completely into the next world. He was buried for a year. And after the year, his bones were brought up and put into an ossuary. And so later on, when the Kaddish developed, the Kaddish was said daily for a year, and then only on the yard site, on the anniversary. The year came slowly to be looked on as a year of trial, a year of purgatory, a year in limbo, a year where the soul was slowly being admitted into heaven, but not the admission was not yet complete. And after this initiatory year, then and only then, was a soul at rest with God. Just next to the grave from which the side of the ossuary which we have of Shimon Bone HaHechal, they found the ossuary of a man by the name of Yochanan ben Haskel. And we don't know very much about him, except he was another of Herod's major servants or courtiers. And what's interesting about this grave is that they found the feet and the bone of the leg pierced by the giant nails which the Romans used to crucify a man. This man had been killed as a criminal, probably for some palace conspiracy, by the Romans, exactly as Jesus is said to have been killed in the New Testament, and the actual nails of the Roman legionaries remain in his bones and with his body to this day. And if you look very carefully at these ossuaries, you'll discover that for the first time symbolism begins to intrude upon the earlier simplicity of our people. One of the ossuaries has a series of rosettes. They look like very primitive fleur-de-lis. Another has a building front, a facade, a columned facade with a narrow triangular or gabled top. This is probably the facade of the temple in Jerusalem, the eternal house. The flower of eternal life, the entrance into the eternal house. The menorah is often used as a symbol of the eternal faith, God's eternal concern, the eternal light. And we have now what was the unique and new element of Pharisaic teaching. This insistence that this life was only the corridor into the life to come, that one's real life began in the next world, and that the real hope, the real promise of man was in the next life. And you can see this too as you examine the items in our Atikot display. Well, it's never fun to talk about death, and I don't mean, I have not meant to be ghoulish or garish in any way this morning. But it is only through the death of the ancient that we come to understand their life. Perhaps, though I doubt it, our ancients had this in mind when they said that the dead leave life to the living. By this they meant that spiritually those who go before, by their teaching and by the institutions that they found and by the freedoms which they establish, they leave us a greater life, greater opportunity. But when it comes to the ancients whom we no longer remember, those whose graves we ransack in order to understand the histories of their time, they leave life to the living in the sense of the things which are found with them and the thing they tell us so much about the world in which they live. When you come into Atikot, you'll see any number of small, narrow, spatulated pottery lamps, oil lamps. They're very simple, many of them, highly decorated, some of them. They were brought to the cemetery in very much the same way that moderns will light a candle at a grave. They were brought with the prayers of those who had loved and who have lost. And these little lights, of course, are interesting in themselves, but they establish in a very real way the identity of humanity between ourselves and our ancestors. For we too need, do we not psychologically and deeply, to light lights for our dead. Not little pottery lights, to be sure, perhaps not even candles, certainly the light of our own life. That's our obligation to them, the way we repay the debt of love that we owe. And you'll see these lights also in Atikot. Amen.